Welcome to the Hall of Blue Illumination, the podcast dedicated to M.A.R. Barker's legendary world of Tecumel.
Hello, everybody in the internet land. Welcome back to the Hall of Blue Illumination. With me today are James Malaszewski.
Hello.
And Victor Raymond.
Hi there.
Today, we are going to discuss how much meta-knowledge the referee should impart unto the players when they begin playing in Tecumel. Does that sound like a reasonable summary of the question?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Who would like to launch in to their opinion on this topic?
Well, we had this as a question, right? This was actually brought up in an online forum about Tecumel, about how much should people reveal? And there was some immediate discussion as to whether or not it's Tecumel's back history is part of the immediate appeal, the sort of frame that people bring to when they sit down to play, or should you try for a sense of verisimilitude that the characters themselves have little, if any, idea about this except in a sort of legendary or mythological way. And so maybe the best thing to do is to not reveal these things to the players, and so that their own ignorance mirrors that of their character's ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Of course, I think the other thing, too, just to talk about, if only briefly, is that this presupposes that the players are not already familiar with Tecumel in some fashion, right? That they're completely fresh to the setting, because I don't believe I've ever encountered anyone playing who knew about Tecumel beforehand who didn't already know all the sort of deep background stuff of the setting. Maybe I'm wrong.
I actually think there's a lot of players out there, and I encounter them at conventions when I run games, who don't really know that much.
Really?
They've heard of Tecumel. They understand there's weirdness, and there's gods, and there's demons, and nobody's got any iron, and there's weird spells and strange things. But aside from a sense of there being this sort of internally consistent, but to them seemingly very gonzo background, they don't really know.
Okay.
My situation is definitely very much the players don't know. I've only run one thing, and that was recently online, where anyone knew anything about the setting prior to me beginning the game. And in introducing my friends over the years to the setting, I would not really have them do anything ahead of time or even give them much of a preamble. Because it seemed like I don't like sitting through long background lectures, so why would my players?
Mm-hmm.
So just getting things rolling through the eyes of the player characters and setting the scene, providing as much information as they need to know in order to play the game.
Right.
Then,
well, I guess
that's always.
Well, I guess that maybe we would clarify. What do we mean by how expansive are we talking about here with regards to meta knowledge? I took it to mean the sort of very deep backstory of Tecumel, namely that it's a world from the far future that's been flung into this extra-dimensional space, and that magic isn't really magic in the supernatural traditional sense of fantasy type thing, and that there's high technology from the past and so forth. Is that what we're talking about, or are we talking about the history of Tecumel?
Well,
that is
I'm thinking more street level stuff, just like the climate, what you see, really anything about the world, I'll introduce in the game. and leave out all of the extra stuff. But the, okay, as a comparison, and it's not a completely accurate one, but it's good enough for me. A friend of mine who is very well versed in Traveler ran a Traveler game at the game store for Free RPG Day, and it was like an hour and a half of explanation of the setting of Traveler and maybe half an hour of gaming.
Right.
So that is the opposite of how I, as a player, would want to experience being introduced to a new setting. Now, that being said, when I've set up games for people who know nothing about Tecumel, it's always been some variant of the fresh-off-the-boat approach. So they really don't need to know anything that their characters would know anyway, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I found myself over time, when I've run particularly convention games, I've come up with a... It's not quite scripted, but it is a somewhat practiced background intro, which emphasizes certain points. You know, the gods are real. This is a metal poor society. Nobody has horses. Society is hierarchical and status matters. And, you know, that sort of thing. And I find that in the midst of, doing this, because I'm limited usually to a 4-hour session, that I don't want to go anywhere past 20 minutes, you know, 10 minutes for, you know, sort of, you know, has everyone turned in their tickets, or, you know, is everyone here, and, you know, sort of getting everyone situated, and then, you know, give a little bit of background. But in the process, then afterwards, spending, you know, maybe another 15 minutes on, you know, going over their characters, and then you know, having it, you know, to as much as possible, have at least 3 hours for gaming, and more so if possible, you know. And so there isn't an awful lot of time in a convention setting to talk about this stuff. Yeah. So.
Well, the question is kind of answered in print, because there are many variations on the elevator pitch for Tecumel, where, you know, there's a page or less describing what the world is. And there's numerous examples of this on the web that one can find that various people have made. And they all do a good job presenting what that particular author wants to present, like what's important to that person. It's, since I'm familiar with the source material, my inclination is just to always go back to the source material. But that's kind of a circular argument if you're trying to pitch this to new players.
Well, I mean, I think it's actually worth considering from a from a somewhat more, how would you say, play concept perspective. I mean, would there be value in specifically excluding some of the deeper knowledge of Tecumel to be a reveal for later?
I think so. Okay. I think, yeah. Having people not know you're in a pocket dimension, that's amazing to me.
Yeah.
There are no stars. What? There are no stars? Yeah, there's never been stars. Your entire life, you've never seen one. You don't know what one is. What?
Star? What are you talking
about?
Actually, you could even take that a step further and say, to say that there are no stars indicates that there's something that they should be missing, right? You could say, yes, all the things that are in the sky, you know, there is, you know, mighty purple Zeruna and then green Gael and red Kashi, the moons and the other planets of Tecumel's system. And in the morning, Tuleng rises and illuminates the land. And, you know, you could talk about that stuff, and people go, wow, that was really picturesque. And then, like, for example, in the scene, there's a scene in Man of Gold where this is when Harsan and I think it's... you know, he's there with Tlayesha, and they are, you know, fleeing from the various denizens of the underworld. And they go through this area where there's this massive roaring wind, and clearly there's a nexus point or something there. And actually, I should be careful about that. I'm not quite sure what the mechanism is, but he goes out onto this looks out upon this rather sere landscape, and there's the myriad twinkling lights in the dark sky, and he doesn't know what he's looking at.
Yep.
Yeah, and that's a case of like, you know, that's the reaction that someone would have. It's like, what the hell are those?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Showing, not telling. But, I get that's where I go.
Yeah. Oh, I have that trouble too. I absolutely do. It's kind of like, you know, and when somebody asks, what do you mean there's no horses? Well, you know, and then I'll go off and, you know, blah, 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 info dump, blah, blah, blah. and it's like, no, there aren't any horses. Everyone goes around on foot. Or by palanquin. That's what you have slaves for.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the difficulty. I mean, I think for like all of us, I'm sure we suffer from this to some extent, is that a great part of the appeal of Tekkenmaw is all these various ways in which it differs from our world and our experience of things. So you want to emphasize those things. Not only do you want to emphasize them, you want to wax poetical about them for a while, because the very fact that there are no stars is a remarkable thing. It leads to all sorts of things. But I always comment, I always tell people that, you know, growing up in an urbanized area, you don't know what it's like to be in the dark until you go out in the country, right? When you're away from those kinds of things. But even then, we still have stars in the sky that illuminate. It's darker than if you're living in the big, but imagine if they're all gone completely, what would that be like? And that's just something fascinating to sort of contemplate. So you want to dwell on that. But at the same time, you want to avoid that info dump where you sort of spend a lot of time talking and drawing attention to this in a way that doesn't further immersion in the setting or advancing whatever adventures and scenarios you're running or things like that. You don't want to turn it into an exercise to just sort of talk at length about the setting rather than to experience the setting, to play in the setting, I think.
Yes. We're back to that crucial issue, and that is, Tekkenmaw is best explored through play. Yeah. No, and I wish there was some way to emphasize this again and again and again.
Well, just keep mentioning it every time it comes up.
I guess it does, doesn't it? Well, there you go. No, but I mean, you're right. I mean, it's like when people have a chance to play, they get to experience both what is perfectly ordinary and also they get to appreciate in their own minds on the moment, you know, oh, wow, this is very different.
There have been a few instances over time where players who knew nothing about Tekkenmaw would then become interested enough to buy the source book or read Man of Gold or whatnot. And that's been pretty gratifying, because then with that person in the group, you have another person who is familiar with the setting, and it can help carry some of the other players who may or may not really care very much.
Yes. Yes. Hey. Yeah. All I was going to say, too, just to sort of add to that or add to my earlier comment, just as that, you know, I think it's great when people do go that route and, you know, use the knowledge they've acquired from that in order to further portray their character and give the setting some sort of a reality. But as always, the same thing too. Tekkenmaw, I find, is a setting that very easily, again, draws people in, and you want to talk about all these fascinating little differences and quirks and ways in which it's different. And it's part of the appeal. It's really truly what draws people in, but you don't want to oversell them sometimes.
That's exactly right. Yeah. You don't want to be too rabid about the setting, because that can be a turnoff for people as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Even people who are intrigued by the setting, I think, can be put off by that, because it makes it feel as if, or it makes them feel rather as if you need to be up on all the minutiae of the setting. And not being willing to just sort of let some of that fall back into the background. Because you don't need, I mean, it, if your adventure or campaign or whatever is about some particular fine details, I think it's great. You know, you zoom in on those things that are most important to you. But a lot of things I don't think are that important to dwell upon unless they serve some particular purpose. I mean, they're great for color from time to time. I know, Victor, you've talked about what Professor Barker used to do from time to time in terms of dropping details to help to paint a picture.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
But I don't imagine, and again, you can correct us if this is wrong, that Professor Barker ever like dwelled on them and made them sort of a point. There will be a test later on this bit of information.
No, there's only tests on your Soliani.
Okay,
there you go. Your pronunciation and comprehension and your written skills. You know, nothing much. No, actually, even there, you know, I mean, Phil certainly appreciated when people use Soliani, but for the most part, he wasn't. He didn't make it a prerequisite for play. The one thing I will say about that, though, is that. One of the things that Phil would do, what Professor Barker would do, is he would introduce things in very much a, well, this is just what you see sort of way, and kind of almost implicitly dare you to, you know, are you going to pay attention to it? Are you going to go and check it out? Or are you going to leave it alone and assume that since it's not attacking you, that it must be okay, you know? And not in a, you know, aha, gotcha sort of way, but mostly a... he would let your own sense of wonder pick it up and you know, you could then make your own decision as a player whether or not you're going to pay attention to it, you know. Mm-hmm. And
right,
and that was done very much as a, well, this is all part of a background, you know, and rather than a, here is the important and weird thing. Let me tell you about the important and weird thing. You know, one of the things about the unknown is that you don't know it. You might notice it, but you don't really, I mean, here's an example for players who've never experienced what a nexus point is like. I mean, you could say, you emerge into a darkened cavern, except for a disc of what appears to be gleaming silver that is hanging in midair, approximately 8 feet across. Okay. And you could say that and have the players then react to it. It's like, what is it? You know, and you know, if their characters aren't advanced enough, they don't have enough background knowledge for these sorts of things because they haven't been to temple school where they talk about, you know, Nexus Points 101.
Don't skip that.
That could be the level of, don't skip that. By the way, always check to make sure you know where it's going first. Right, okay. The other way of doing it is the kind of info dump. You know, you emerge into a darkened cavern and you see in front of you a nexus point. It is hanging in midair, it's silvery, you know, nexus points connect you to other places on Techamel and other dimensions, and you're not really sure of where they go unless you have the appropriate spell, and so what are you going to do? You know, I have now just given away the house.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. When I really have to say, actually, some of the most fun I have ever had when I was playing with Professor Barker was we would encounter something completely different and we'd be like, okay, I guess we're going to have to puzzle through this.
Oh, sure. Of course. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's absolutely.
The fun of it.
I truly think so. Yeah, definitely.
I mean, the extreme version of this are the how do you determine what an eye does, right? And it got to the point, apparently, amongst early players of Techamel, that you had to assemble a certain number of objects and use the eye in a certain number of ways in order to figure out what it might be. right? So you need to have a slave, you need to have a tree, you need to have a jug of wine, and it sort of had to have all and some rope and, you know, and tie the slave to the rope, you know. And all of that being a, so if it doesn't have an immediate effect, well, you just click until you can puzzle out by dint of some kind of logic what it's supposed to do.
Yeah.
Which
hope you don't use too many charges.
And hope you don't use too many charges. Hope it isn't damaged. Hope it isn't an eye that doesn't appear on the list, which is certainly possible. I mean, there's no particular reason why an eye has to be off of the list of the 36 that are in the book.
Or you could go and visit those extremely trustworthy priests of Xarl and see if they could tell you what it is.
Yeah, well, but what they don't tell you is in the basement they've got a slave and a rope and a jug of wine and a tree.
You see, my personal experience is that whenever I should do that, they tell me, oh, this is completely worthless. We'd be willing to take it off your hands, though, for a mere 50 kaitars.
Yeah, oh, exactly.
Mere 50 kaitars.
Mere, that's right. Well, you see, they, you know, they
are... Well, I should say a generous. It's worthless. It's completely useless. But here, we'll give you kaitars for your trouble and bring it to us.
See, yes, that all sounds more fun than the Gamma World artifact activation table.
My goodness gracious, that I...
Although I had fun with that. I can't.
I just didn't get it back then. I looked at that chart and I'm like, this does not look like fun to me. I'm sure other people have had many enjoyable experiences with it, but I just said, no, this is not something I want to present in my game.
All right.
I was just thinking about this. I know that different people have come up with different charts. In fact, I recall there being someone had come up with the simple and then moderately complex and the fiendishly complex artifact charts for Gamma World. And at one point, I actually thought about adapting that to Tecamel and seeing what you could do with it there. And I don't see any reason why you couldn't do that. It's a device of the ancients. What do you do? But it also presupposes that in the end you'll have some weird idea of what it does, and that doesn't necessarily happen.
No, and in fact, I think that's one of the reasons why it's great if you are in a situation where the players don't know anything about Tecamel and its backstory and deep history, because you present something like an eye, and well, it's not immediately apparent. I mean, if we were to encounter one in the real world, and so you find this thing, it's like, who would think that it's some kind of a tool that is supposed to be aimed in a particular direction and that it can produce a variety of different effects depending on what particular sort of thing it is? It's kind of unclear. And what I like about many of the Tecamel the devices of the ancients and the other, you know, magical items is that they frequently don't look, they're products of a culture unlike our own, many millennia into the future, and for circumstances that don't exist in our world. So it would be very hard to be able to anticipate what they are or guess simply by looking at them. And it's enjoyable and fun and leads to all sorts of interesting situations when you have to grapple with them, when the players are forced through their characters to sort of figure out, well, what is this? What can we do with it? It's fun.
There are any a number of examples of this sort of thing that are out there on Tecamel that I can talk about sort of anecdotally.
Please.
I remember now in one of these cases, I actually encountered this, and in a couple of the others, they were things that were related to me later. Somewhere in an underworld, the party had found a box that was full of these small ovoid metal sort of pineapple shaped things that had a ring off of the top, and that they were being pursued by Sue, and they thought to themselves, aha! We know what we have found. We will pick these up and pull the rings and fling them back at the Sioux. And they did that, and the pineapples flipped open, you know, split along their long axis and split into two halves and just sort of sat there. And they weren't grenades. They were, as far as we can tell, they must have been some sort of, I mean, I wasn't there, but when we're talking about it later, they had been some sort of, the interior of the pineapple was filled with some sort of gooey substance that we thought was essentially some sort of lubricant for something, and that the exterior pineapple shape was to give you a grip on it as you were applying it to whatever thing needed it. You know, but it, you know, things, this was a case of, I think, Phil wanting to use players' assumptions against them, or at least, you know, being completely unwilling to reward them. And you know, there are other examples of this. There was, I think this was, one of the player characters, I think this would have been Mike Huggins' player character, had used an eye on an eye of retaining all things on this behemoth that he had found in the underworld. It was this large metal wheeled cart that had an arm that picked things up.
Oh, and I know this story. I know this.
Yeah. And the thing about it is that, you know, this is reported in one of the dispatches to the Imperium. You know, you can go look this up in Dragon Number 4 or in the Strategic Review articles. And actually, what it actually was is a trash collector of the ancients. It's a robotic trash collector. It picks up the bin and very carefully places it on the back, you know, loading area, and then moves on to the next bin and picks that, you know, and all of that. But that particular fact, I mean, Phil never revealed that. That actually only came out in a letter. And maybe the players found out about it later, but that was before my time. And then the last one of something like this is that the energy weapons of the ancients were not eyes, per se. They had actually energy weapons that were like, oh, meter-long rods with a stud. And they were not exactly, you know, they were not rifle-shaped. They were just, you pointed them in the right direction, you pressed the stud, and a bolt of energy would come out. Okay. But it's, you know, very easily the sort of thing, you know, huh, I wonder where that points. Oh, look, there's a stud here. I'm going to look down, you know, and see if there, you know, do I see anything when I press the stud? Well, you know, the paradises of Terra Tenere. That's what you see. You know,
there you Everyone go. Else, on the other hand.
Ooh. But yeah, I mean, I guess in a sense the preservation of verisimilitude is such, yeah, now that's the spell we need.
The preservation of verisimilitude. Yeah.
Which temple is that associated with?
Yeah. It's a generic spell. It's across a couple of temples.
Oh, okay. It's a generic spell.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Yeah. But you know, I guess in a way of talking about this, I mean, there are some things, there are some pieces to the background that I think are worth, you know, paying attention to. Well, there's two things I want to point out. One is the fact that Tekemel has background secrets that are not revealed, that in fact that there's layers of this, right? Is something that some players find immensely off-putting. You know, I had one fellow say, oh, yeah, that's right, Barker. Yeah, you just took all that stuff from anthropology books, and it's all these big background secrets. Yeah, I don't want to play that. And to which my reply was, okay.
Yeah, moving on.
Moving on, you know. But there is the sort of player who they want to know. They want to know the thing, right? And they will stoutly insist that their character, they will never play their character in order to reveal that they, you know, they know that thing. That as a player, they're good about that. They won't let that happen. And I'm not sure that's actually true. I mean, I guess this is an argument for sort of a soft retention of ideas, or, you know, maybe not a, you know, complete, Not a complete non-disclosure, but, you know, hold some stuff back, because if everybody knew everything, then, well, why bother?
Well, true. And this is something that frustrates me a little bit about over concern about, you know, all the secrets and so forth that people have, because it, as a friend of mine made this observation once, and it's true, it's like, we don't know all the secrets in the real world. No one complains about what a terrible game it is, right? Because you can't know all these things. So I don't see why. I mean, why would a Soljani necessarily know or even care about a lot of these things? These are clearly the kind of things that players are interested in. But I mean, in terms of running a successful and enjoyable Tecmo campaign, or even more narrowly, just an adventure, I mean, much of this information is not needed. It's just, it's nice. I mean, I enjoy it. I mean, we all do, obviously, if we're sitting here talking about this. We like Tecmo on that level. We enjoy it on a high level. But to have an enjoyable campaign, or, as I say, even an adventure, much of that information is just unnecessary. I don't see why. I guess it's just a tribute, in a way, as I've said before, to how compelling the material is, that people obsess over it and want to find a way to ferret out all these little secrets and find ways to include them in their games. But it isn't needed by any stretch of the imagination. At least that's not been my experience.
Yeah, I am with you in all of that. I actually think that there just isn't enough time. I think you risk the, you know, sort of the info dump taking over from
what you're
there for. And it, at least in defense of some people who like knowing things, there is a way in which, if you know something, it is possible for you to consciously play your character in a way so as to play up their ignorance. You know, they're being that moment of like, yeah,
player definitely
knows, but,
that's true.
The character does not.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that somewhat facile. I'm not saying you can't do it. Hell, I've done it. But there's a way in which, in the end, it's kind of like, ha ha ha, you know, we're going to laugh behind our hands. Our characters don't know these things, but we do. And who knows, maybe I'm not giving enough benefit of the doubt for people who like doing that.
Well, if you cast the preservation of verisimilitude first, then it works out, and it's just called good role playing.
That's right. That's true.
Oh,
well done.
I should have seen that. I should have anticipated that.
So let's flip the question around here. So this is a situation I have not been in, but I imagine that judges who do more stuff at conventions may have. And that is, what happens when you get someone at your table who is a living encyclopedia of the minutia of Tecmo lore, and you yourself may not really know as much, and you get challenged on what is correct and what isn't?
That's a good question, actually.
Right. Well, I've actually had that happen a few times.
This should be a good story.
Well, I mean, there are players out there who really, really, really enjoy the setting. I mean, I feel as though some of these, there are people who are like this for any richly developed setting. Heck, there are Tolkien fans out there who, you know, probably speak better Kenyan and Sindarin than I do. I mean, that would be easy because I don't do it. I don't really do either of them. There you are. One of the things to do, and I think this is an important thing to emphasize, is, yeah, if you go there, if you talk about something, and you'd better be ready to understand what it is when someone comes back and says, oh, well, I thought Schlen had six legs, you know, yeah, whatever. And I'm drawing an example purely out of thin air. And you have a number of choices, one of them being, well, this is my Tecmo, which some people aren't very happy with.
My Mechasro.
My Mechasro, right. there's also the answer of you were immediately on the moment making something up. Ah, you're not familiar with this breed. This is a breed that was originally, you know, from the highlands outside Thrace in Livianu. No one knows why. They only have four legs.
That's how I roll. Yeah.
That's pretty much what I do, too. Exactly. I think that's the
And the thing about it is that, the third response is to say something along the lines of like, this one, the legs have been amputated, or, you know, something where you just cover on the moment for why it looked that way.
You know, it's also okay to just admit that you're wrong in a detail. Yes. You know,
and I've done that too.
There you go. I mean, if the person is like not trying to call you out, maybe they're genuinely trying to be helpful or just kind of participating in making the story more enjoyable, then, you know.
And 9 times out of 10, that's what they're doing. That is, you know.
I don't mean to interrupt, but I have had situations where someone has asked in a way that is clearly they were confused. They're saying, oh, well, I thought, I'll give you an example. When in my Mughal Abhyani campaign, I was describing something out in the wilderness in the west of Mughal Abhyani. And I inadvertently, again, this ties into something I said previously, had implied there were stars in the sky. And someone said, wait a minute, I thought there were no stars on Tekemel. I thought I read that somewhere. And I'm like, oh, yes, you're right. I just slipped. You just sort of say, you know, outright say, oh, that's wrong. Because it's very easy to forget these things.
Yes, it is.
And that was it. And it was presented. It wasn't a, oh, what? You don't even know this setting kind of thing. I thought that was what you were going to say. I thought, because they asked the question in a genuine way as to, you know, was I misinformed? And in some cases, I will say, well, no, you weren't misinformed. But in fact, you know, this is the case. That's back to the four-legged Schlen, for example. But in this case, it was just, I slipped. I slipped up. I made a mistake. And you say, you're right. There aren't. I didn't mean to say that. It's just so easy to forget these things.
And that's actually a very fair response. And I've done that too. You know, I've had people say, hey, wait a second. What about this? And for what it's worth, not that I remember any specific instance, but I do recall, generally speaking, that from time to time, even Phil, even Professor Barker, would slip up on his own world. And
I slip up on the real world all the time.
Yeah, well, you know. So, what? You don't know everything about your own world? What's wrong with you?
No, sometimes I don't. Well, I mean, I don't remember things that I actually know. And it's sort of like, but you know this. It's like, you're right, I do. But for some reason, I couldn't recall the detail. But anyway,
yeah. I will say that I think that there is some structure to this that's worth paying attention to. That I don't think that there's anything wrong with sort of consciously thinking about the things that are going to require a reveal at some point. The two-way car network, which gets a mention just once in maybe twice in the original EPT source book. The two-way car network it was the subject of considerable puzzlement to the original players of Tekemel. I mean, they didn't figure it. Oh yeah, no, they did not understand immediately what was going on. I mean, what we now think of as being sort of settled Tekemel lore, there is a golden disc that has the destinations, and that there are 10 destinations, and they all appear on a screen, you know, some sort of, and all of that. That was not immediately understood. And so, I mean, I think for anybody who's, I mean, if you think about it, this is something that only a very small number of people are going to know in the world.
True.
You know, so unless you're traveling with one of the you know, experts of the Omnipotent Azure Legion, whose job it is to operate the two-way car. Well, you know, that's it should be a mystery initially. I mean, eyes in their own way are sufficiently common that they're not so much. I mean, they're certainly talked about enough, and certainly it's implied that there's at least some understanding that, oh yes, these are devices that do things.
Right.
Like, okay, that's fine. But Nexus points and how Nexus points operates. And where do they go and what do they do and all of that. I have to tell you that there were a number of gaming sessions at Professor Barker's where the adventure du jour was, well, we're trying to get somewhere across the multiverse and we're going to go through Nexus points, and won't that be exciting? and we sometimes didn't have much of a sense on where to go. One of my characters actually ended up having a spell that was similar to that of the Periplus of the Plains at a relatively high level. It was a spell which I had dubbed the Persistent Locator, that which simply meant that if we were going somewhere via Nexus Point, that we would be able to tell which Nexus Point would take us there the most quickly, and hopefully safely. You know, the Nexus Points are another one. The nature of the gods, that's another one, you know, that which to Ziciliani would probably not seem to be, I mean, it's a sort of recondite question that would end up happening in temple theory schools, but past that, most Ziciliani would say the gods are the gods. What is the nature of your inquiry, right? You know, or for that matter, the myriad planes, the demon planes themselves, which are both mythological but also accessible, right? That if you want to go to the 33rd plane in order to find the realm of Lord Tekel, and by the way, I may be completely wrong about all those different pieces. I didn't look at the book.
I'm sure you'll get an email about how you possibly confused.
Yeah, that's
a totally different demon.
No, it's not. Yeah, it's not that at all.
My Tree of Time, my Demon Hells.
My Demon Hells, right. Well, but, I mean, you know, putting that stuff out, I mean, actually, I think there's actually kind of an interesting adventure that you could have around treating the Book of Ebon Bindings and some of the other books in you know, sort of books of lore as being their own campaign arc. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, do you want to be like one of the wizards of old, you know, and maybe you're in way over your head, maybe you're just some poor, you know, investigator a la Call of Cthulhu, but, you know, how are you supposed to divine the nature of the multiverse unless you go and visit these places and see these things?
That's right, you know. Comma, James, period.
Yeah, well, absolutely. No. That's
my character's goal.
What I was going to say jokingly was sort of like, I'm working on it.
How else are you supposed to have a chance to be completely opened up from stem to stern and then put back together and then attached to the font of Evidlu, thus to have the waters of the unending gray pour through your body and your soul to know nothing else?
A quick consultation with my own, you know, secret copy of the Book of Ebon Bindings reveals that Lord Tekel governs the 11th plane.
11th plane.
Yes, so the 33rd plane is unknown, and it's in fact, no one has never been mentioned. Says to write the numerals of the plane is foolhardy. So bear that
in mind for future conversation.
Well, if I'm not here next week, you'll know where I am.
Well, I'm only saying them. I'm not writing them. Not so fool as to write it. My Tsoyani, after all, is abominable. I don't know how to do almost anything in Tsoyani, let alone new.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, these are the sorts of things, though, that in a somewhat you can make them part of, you know, an amazing part of the background in full Technicolor, or you can more deftly slowly introduce them in their own way.
Slowly, you know, and I vote slowly and deftly.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
I think having a one sheet at the top of the campaign with, you know, I don't know how many bullet points, not too many, 3 to 7, that is probably plenty to get the ball rolling.
Exactly. And I think too, I mean, my experience, which is not typical, but I mean, when dealing with people of varying degrees of knowledge and interest in the intricacies of Techmel, it's providing, when they don't know things and they ask questions, that's an opportunity to, I hope, or at least I've tried, not to sort of dwell at great length to sort of launch into some kind of exposition, but sort of to sort of show what that means, you know, and how it plays out in the life of a Solyani or whoever as they're encountering it. It's sort of like, oh, they're interested in this thing. Good. Then they'll encounter somebody who, you know, deals with this issue, or hell, you know, as they're wandering the streets of Jakala, they'll see something that'll make it more real to them exactly what that means. But that's what I try to do anyway.
No, I think that's great. I mean, otherwise it ends up being just an endless variation on the old joke about science. Was it Golden Age science fiction writers and light bulbs? How many Golden Age science fiction writers does it take to change a light bulb?
I don't believe you know the answer to that.
Well, James, as we all know, when you flip the switch, a signal is sent to a power station that presents the, you know, and
yes. That's actually a pretty good joke.
Well, how many new science fiction writers does it take to change a light bulb?
I assume it'll be just as funny, but please tell me.
No. Let me tell you about how my light bulb works.
There you go. Very good.
Yeah. How many proofreaders does it take to change a light bulb?
Proofreaders.
But it did sound like he said perforators.
Proofreaders.
Please, enlighten us. No pun intended.
Proofreaders can't change light bulbs. They can only query. All right, I'll stop now.
Please. We don't want to end on a low note.
No, I think we're good. I think in my mind, I said cut in my mind after the first joke, and I think we'll be good at that point. That's 46 minutes of solid content and one joke.
One joke.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to the Hall of Blue Illumination. You can email us your questions, queries, and other topics at citizen@techmlpodcast.com. You can also find TechML Podcast on Twitter and Facebook. Until next time, take care and have fun playing in the world of TechML.